Z1077 welcomes you to Up Close, a weekly public affairs program presented by Z1077 News. You're invited to call in with your questions and comments. Our call-in number is 366-8471. Now, your host for Up Close, Gary Danielle.
Well, thank you, mystery announcer, wherever you are, and happy birthday yesterday. And welcome to the Z1077 Up Close Show, a special presentation of Z1077 News presented in the public interest. I'm Gary Danielle, your host. Our producer is Michelle Alley. A number for you to call is 760-366-8471. Our guest in studio today is Chris Clark, the California Associate Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Did I get the title right, Chris?
California Desert Program Association.
California
Director.
Desert Program.
It's
okay.
Way too long.
That's a good title. Yeah. Anyway, thanks for coming out. We appreciate you coming.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, I just want to say ahead of time. Now, Chris is planning an event next month to talk about sustainability and tourism in our area. We'll get into that in a little bit. So what we're going to be doing is asking you to tell us what you would like that program to cover, what questions you'd like to hear that. So we're going to come back to that in just a little bit. But that's what's going on today. We want your input for the event that Chris is planning. And I guess you can give us kind of an overview of what it's about.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And what is it all about?
Well, basically, before the pandemic started, we'd started a sort of a community conversation, including David Smith, the former superintendent of Joshua Tree National Park, and representatives of nonprofits like Mojave Desert Land Trust and Joshua Tree National Park Association, as well as ourselves, some folks that work in the tourism trade in the neighborhood, you know, whether they're owners of restaurants or people that clean Airbnbs after people are done visiting or whatever that is. And it was an important conversation, and then the pandemic set in and we couldn't meet in person anymore. It kind of fell by the wayside. But with the recent Meteor-geddon, as I think some people are calling
That's
it.
That's what I've written. I got Meteor-mageddon.
Yep. Yeah. It just seemed like it was an appropriate time. There's a lot of public interest. I think we could get some good energy from the community to talk about ways that we can make things better.
Well, let's go right to the meat of that. And that was what we called Meteor-mageddon. A lot of the locals had no idea that was coming. However, those in the tourist industry, one of our reporters, Robert Hayden, said he says, I'm not quite sure what's going on. And this was the Friday morning before that. He said, but every Airbnb and motel and hotel and lodging and campsite everywhere are completely booked up. Something's going on. And we're all going, what the heck? What's going on? Mm-hmm. Is there a concert somewhere? Is Coachella doing it? What is going on? And then it hit us, the meteor shower. Apparently, there are at least two major Los Angeles television stations who were telling the 2 million residents of L.A. that are 2 hours away that the best place to watch the meteor shower was Joshua Tree National Park.
Mm-hmm.
The only people who didn't know about that was Joshua Tree National Park. And I think everybody got blindsided. From your point of view, Chris, what happened?
Well, I think that's exactly what happened. That, you know, you have news directors in L.A. that see that a topic is popular and they want to capitalize on it. And it's sort of service journalism from their point of view, you know, telling people how to have a good time. That's what they do. And as someone that used to work in that world, I'm very sympathetic to the fact that they didn't have bad intentions. I've been trying to put together meetings with some of the news directors from some of those sites saying, here, let's talk about how we can do this better next time.
And people like celestial phenomenon, and the desert's always a good place to come see it. We traditionally, as a local station, we run the stories when we have meteor showers, mm-hmm. and you know, eclipses and cool stuff that are happening in the sky, because people who live out here have a good view of the sky and are very interested in it. And traditionally, those stories that we run get a lot of legs on social media,
right.
And you know, we've got a pretty extensive social media network that the radio station sustains, and that was getting a lot of interest. So we knew the interest was out there. How do we communicate that to park management? I think they were completely taken blindsided.
Well, I can't really speak for how Jane Rogers, the superintendent, and her crew over there, I can't really speak to how well informed they were on this, but I think a lot of us were taken by surprise by it that don't have direct ties to the visitation industry.
When we contacted the California Highway Patrol the day after, they said we had no idea, because the question was, why didn't we have extra law enforcement? And they had no idea. But it was just completely out of the blue.
But I think the key there is that some people in the community, as you mentioned, did know.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm hoping to accomplish by getting a bunch of people together to start talking about this again is to open up those lines of communication so that someone from the Chamber of Commerce nearby can say, hey, we're getting all these mentions of people not being able to find Airbnbs because everything's booked up, and then, you know, sharing that information with the National Park Service, with the local region of Caltrans and CHP, with the sheriffs, you know, just so that we can all be operating on the same page and know what's coming.
We ought to be able to anticipate and plan for those types of events.
Exactly right.
We're talking to Chris Clark from the National Parks Conservation Association, and later on in September, they will be putting together an event to talk about sustainable management and communication between the different interests. Here we've got tourism, we've got law enforcement, we've got management, we've got all that going on. So what we'd like to hear from you is call us right now at 760-366-8471 and tell us what you would like that session to include. What do you think are important issues that need to be resolved, or we need to find out more about them? 760-366-8471. Our producer, Michelle Alley, is standing by. But we would like you to tell us what the issues are for the planned forum that is coming up. I guess that's the easiest way to put that. So
yeah, that would be really wonderful to hear from folks.
Now, you work a lot with the different agencies. It is unusual to get law enforcement involved in something like tourism management. But in this particular case, they should have been.
Yeah, they definitely have a very important role to play. You know, we've seen how effective they can be with this recent storm, where they were really on top of the road damage and all these other issues that came up with the excessive rainfall. They know how to do their job. And if there's some way that they can have a little advance notice that, hey, Park Boulevard is going to be bumper to bumper and 0 miles an hour for the next 48 hours. You know, they can get in there and let emergency vehicles in and do all that kind
now,
of planning.
They did react well. I have to say, my wife and I were the MCs for the summer concert in Yucca Valley that night, and we left the concert and heading just at a snail's pace, literally bumper to bumper, to Joshua Tree. And as we reached the middle of Joshua Tree, two guys in big old pickup trucks started passing everybody in the middle lane. And sure enough, bam, Sheriff's deputy was on them. So they were doing some traffic control.
Mm-hmm.
I think once they realized what was going on, they got some units to there. So pat on the back for the sheriff for reacting quickly to that, because they were doing a lot of traffic control in the downtown Joshua Tree area on the highway, which isn't really their primary it's not really their jurisdiction.
Right.
That's CHP. But they reacted to it, and I watched them take care of a couple of knuckleheads, and I think they went home with a citation. But it was a matter of just keeping everybody safe.
Yeah.
A lot of people were going up on dirt roads because they thought they'd get around the traffic. Well, now we've got people stuck on dirt roads, so you're just compounding the problem. It was a mess. But again, pat on the back for the sheriff. Now, the CHP, who that we spoke to the next day, said they were just completely taken by surprise. They had no mm-hmm. idea. So one of the things we'd want to find out this form is, how do we build that link? Who would, you know, is it a phone tree or a set of emails that would go to, you know, Captain Warwick here and the CHP and say, hey, that we might be wanting to see what's going on XX date, because this is happening in the park or this is happening nearby, and there could be a big influx in tourists.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that I'm hoping that will result from this forum, this event, is continued conversation, obviously. But if there is, you know, a core working group of people that have the ability to do something to make life better when we're getting these barrages of tourism, whether that's, you know, the people doing traffic control, law enforcement, whether it's having the Park Service have a bit more advanced warning on how they can manage stuff. Maybe they open up a campground that's
normally
been closed,
not open. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, they know how to approach these things, and they do a great job managing the park with very limited resources, which is one of the things I think that we'll be talking about at this forum.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to you about that in a little bit. So,
but it really boils down to people need to be talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to try and get that started.
And again, we here at the radio station, we try to keep our ear close to the ground. It was Robert Hayden, who said, something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I can't figure out what it is, but something's going on. So we started feeling that vibe. We're going to come back with Chris Clark from the National Park Conservation Association in just a few moments. Don't go away. You're listening to the Z1077 Up Close Show. I'm Gary Dagneau. And we will be right back.
Sue's Health Food, committed to your good health.
This is Cody Joseph from The Morning Show with Cody and Jeff. Sue's Health Foods is a regular stop for me. I can get staples there that I can't find at the grocery store. Everything from booch to nooch, as Jeff likes to say. Cashews in bulk, miso paste, local honey, and sweet treats for my kids. They really like the fruit chews from the bulk bins. The bulk bins are probably our favorite part of the store, and the employees are always so friendly and helpful. We couldn't make half the recipes we love without the ingredients we get from Sue's. My family has been shopping there for years, and the quality and care we have gotten has always been top-notch. I love going there, and I love supporting a local business that has given so much to our community for so many years.
Sue's Health Food, committed to your good health.
You know that Firehouse Subs has the tastiest subs in the high desert, but did you know about their magnificent pizza sub mashup? The pepperoni pizza meatball sub. Italian meatballs, extra provolone, and crispy pepperoni on a toasted garlic bread roll. It's back for a limited time. Download the app today for deals and discounts. A portion of every purchase at Firehouse Subs helps provide life-saving equipment to first responders. Firehouse Subs, enjoy more subs, save more lives. In the Home Depot Center, Yucca Valley.
And we are back with the Z1077 Up Close Show. We do have a caller. We'll go right to them. And Tad, you are on the radio. Your comment, please.
Hi there. You've addressed this a little bit, but my question is, we also have these planned events such as the Super Bloom and whatnot, and I think that the park and law enforcement does an excellent job managing these events. But what more can we do to educate these visitors? Can we talk to these news stations to educate visitors, or what else can we do to help lower the impact?
So you're suggesting as a subject at the upcoming forum that we ask, what else can we do to get everybody on online? That is good, and I think kind of what we were talking about.
Yeah, and
definitely.
And hey, Tad, that's a great question, and I think, you know, the way I look at it in the broadest possible sense is that we have a resource that's coming into our community. We're not using that resource, so it becomes a problem. You know, too much of anything, one person visiting Joshua Tree is a fantastic thing. Too much of any fantastic thing, if it's not put to good use, is a problem. But if we were able to, like you said, educate people that are visiting the desert, maybe some of them would decide to go to Trona to watch meteor showers or something like that. But those that show up here, at least, it'd be great to try and get a certain percentage of them to leave their trip being committed to protecting the desert to helping the communities in the Morongo Basin live sustainably. And even if we get 1% of annual visitors to Joshua Tree National Park engaged in that kind of way, that's thousands and thousands of new defenders of the desert and of Joshua Tree that we could be working with. So I think just education is really the key, and that can run the gamut from shows like this or KTLA or KPCC doing things on how to be a good desert visitor to people putting guidelines and do's and don'ts lists on the coffee tables at Airbnbs prominently. So there's just a lot of work we could be doing there, and it's a really important question. I think that's the central question, really.
Thanks, Ted. We appreciate your input today. All right. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye. Okay.
Yeah, I could see like a master list be put together in this year. Here's the celestial events that will be happening. Here's the planned events that are happening. Are we going to have a super bloom? Are we not going to have a super bloom?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, even when we don't have a super bloom, they call it a super bloom because that's just what they call it nowadays.
Yep.
It's like it's not the moon anymore.
Super means spring, I guess.
Yeah. It's not the moon anymore. It's the blood super orchid dust green moon. I mean, we've got all these things we've got to do to popularize natural phenomenon, apparently.
If you want a very lively show, get an astronomer in here and talk to her about the different kinds of moons and all the hype that goes around them. They'll have some things to say.
Oh, you'll have to give me a name. I want to come back a little bit. We kind of got right into the meat of what we're going to talk about, but I want to introduce you a little bit more. Now, Chris Clark lives up here. How long have you lived in our desert up here?
It's been a little bit more than a decade for the Morongo Basin. Moved up here in 2012. I'd been in Palm Springs for a couple of years before that. Been living in the desert in general since 08, so it's a good long time.
But you were an environmental reporter for KCET for years, and that's sort of what got you into onto the conservation wing of things?
No, they hired me because I was already there.
Okay, all right.
But, I've spent a bunch of time being an environmental advocacy journalist, not objective at all. up in the Bay Area, I'm one of those Bay Areans that came down here and never left, and I apologize to all of you for that. But it's just always been something that I care deeply about. Even when I was working, running magazines and things like that up in the Bay Area, I came to the desert every chance I got, and I spent time camping on Sima Dome and Mojave National Preserve. I'd find 4-day weekends or make 4-day weekends and go there. The desert is really what I want to do with the rest of my life. And to that end, one of the things that I've got going lately is a podcast that is actually a co-sponsor of this upcoming event.
90 Miles from Needles, is that what it's called?
That is what it's called.
Okay. Yeah.
I do that with my buddy Alicia Pike, who is one of those people that's in the tourism industry and getting the inside info from knowing which things are booked up. And we're just we're covering the entire desert, so Utah to Baja. But it's where I want to be. This is home. I've looked for home for a long time, and about 12 years ago I got here.
So. Now, the National Park Conservation Association, you work for them. That's who's your employer. What is your responsibility for NPCA?
The California desert is where I work for NPCA. I'm the program manager for the California, or the program associate director. I used to be the program manager. We have a new program manager named Luke Basulto, who was born and raised in Barstow, and he's great.
Yeah, I'm using the simplest title I have here.
So. Yep. Yeah. my actual full title, due to the extreme generosity of friends of ours, is the Ruth Hammett Associate Director of the California Desert Program. Ruth and her husband Ben, longtime desert rats, and they endowed this position.
Yeah,
so,
good. Yeah.
So that's a great thing. Yeah. But Luke and I work to protect all of the parks in the California desert. So from the north end of Death Valley National Park, all the way down through the south end of Joshua Tree, and actually, depending on what's going on with border issues, sometimes we pay attention to the De Anza Trail, which is a National Park Service co-managed trail, historic trail. We basically try and look out for the parks. We have a bunch of different partners that can alert us to when there's a local issue that threatens a park. sometimes we disagree with the National Park Service and we take them to task and we try to get them to do the right thing.
I was going to ask you about that, what your relationship is. So if you think they're doing something wrong, you'll say, hey, I think you're doing this wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And not like a blind support.
And the National Parks Conservation Association has been around for more than 100 years, so we have some cred with the National Park Service. And it takes a lot for us to sue them, but we have done it on occasion. We also, because the California desert is not a few national parks that are separated by completely developed, settled places like some of the parks back east, but instead you have these stretches of intact ecological habitat that have been undisturbed for the most part.
The Joshua Tree into the Mojave National Preserve, into the, there's more protection areas being set up.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, unlike some of my colleagues back east, we pay attention to the land that's outside the parks pretty closely, too. So my predecessor, David Lamfrum, was very much involved in getting the Mojave Trails National Monument established. Even though that's BLM and we're not technically working as a companion agency to the BLM, but out here, the land is the land. And so we pretty much try and pay attention to the entire stretch of land from Death Valley down to the border.
A couple of years ago, there was a new term that came in desert management called sustainable tourism, and I think that is something that needs to be looked at. Can you define sustainable tourism for me, Chris?
Probably not.
Okay.
Because sustainable is one of those words that means something different to every different person, and that's been the case since the 1990s when the term first came up into popular use. I think there was a global conference in Rio de Janeiro, and that was the hashtag. If they'd had hashtags back then, that's what it would have been. But I think what people generally mean when they talk about that is tourism that provides a source of support for communities. You know, Joshua Tree is very dependent economically on people coming through and spending money. And there isn't anything intrinsically wrong with that. It's just a question of how are we set up to accommodate the folks that want to come see what we're all about? How do we make sure that they have as good and safe a time as possible while doing minimal damage to natural resources or to community institutions and the housing market? We need to find a way for us locals, including people like myself who are sort of neo-locals and people who were born and raised here, to be able to interact with people that are just visiting for a few hours and have that work out. So it involves effects on housing, it involves effects on pay rates for people that work in the tourism supporting industry. It involves educating tourists so that they don't have unauthorized campfires in August when everything's dry and it's really windy. There's just the whole gamut.
So one of the things that we may want to consider for your forum is at what point would we close the park? I mean, when Meteor Mageddon happened, there was serious damage done to the park. People driving off roads, and people were just, because they're getting there at 2 and 3 a.m. I heard a couple of stories of people who just found an empty spot and lit a campfire.
Yeah.
Just at what point do we determine that protecting the park is more important than letting people in to see it?
That's a really important question, and there's not an easy answer to it. The Park Service has two different missions from day one of the establishment of the Park Service. The Organic Act of 1916 charges the Park Service with protecting the resources in the park, so making sure that Half Dome doesn't get carted away by quarrying companies or whatever that might happen. And at the same time, while protecting the resources, the Park Service is charged with making those places available for public enjoyment.
Joshua Tree National Park has been over capacity Meteor Mageddon was just one symptom of a longer problem. And at one point, they tried to get a shuttle service because the park had become so full of visitors. Basically, it's a drive-through park. You can't stop and look at anything because there's no parking.
Mm-hmm.
So they tried this shuttle thing, but it just didn't take. What was the problem with that?
It was a really interesting project, and the company now known as Basin Transit was a wonderful partner in that. It was a great idea, and people just are reluctant to get out of their cars. I think that kind of thing can work better if you have a designated large parking area that's really obvious. Zion National Park, for instance, it's a bit different because there's only one way in and out of the main section of Zion National Park, and they've been able to limit traffic to just shuttles.
My wife and I visited Denali.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you park in a parking lot and get on a park bus.
Yep.
That's you don't drive in that park.
Yeah. But with Joshua Tree, there's a few things going on that make that more difficult. We have a couple of entrances to the park that most people use, and they go past a kiosk, and you could put an arm down there to make sure that nobody gets in. This is relevant both to closing the park and to suggestions that people have had, like there should be a reservation system like they have at Arches or like they had at Yosemite for a while, or timed entry or something like that, where you let people in, but you control the flow of how many can get in at once. And those are really, really interesting approaches that can work for a lot of parks. But until you get a kiosk down at Cottonwood, where people have to talk to a ranger before they get into the park, which doesn't exist, that's going to be hard to implement. We have the road into Covington Flat, which, you know, gets you into a really important section of the park, and there is no infrastructure there. There's just a bunch of different ways to get into the park that don't involve going past a ranger who's going to.
I live in the Indian Cove area, and it's a little island there, but it's not. You can't get into the rest of the park from there.
Well, unless you're willing to climb or take a walk up the Boy Scout Trail.
Yeah. So when the gates would come down, how we would manage that? How would we control the flow through? Is another one a subject that can be on the forum that you've got coming up next month. So be listening for that, by the way. We'll have information here. And Chris doesn't have a whole lot of information because he's just putting the pieces together right now.
Yeah, so. But if people want, they can give a call to 760-392-1996 and leave a voicemail message just saying, please let me know when it is. Or
repeat that again, please.
760-392-1996. That is the voicemail number for the 90 Miles from Needles podcast.
Okay, and I will give this to our receptionist here, so if somebody wants to call a radio station, they can get that. Wait till we're done, please. So
yeah, and even better than calling to say, please let me know when it is, would be calling and leaving a message saying, I want to help. We're definitely very, very much dependent on people in the community thinking this is a good idea. We've already gotten some immediate feedback from local nonprofits, from local businesses, and a lot of residents that just, they really want to be involved because it's a conversation whose time has long since come.
Yeah, and typically and traditionally, the population around Joshua Tree have been very, very concerned with the park and the sustainability and the management and the visitors. And I think by and large, we've done the best we can with what we've got. I remember some years ago, I was at a meeting that was called basically the Chambers of Commerce, that kind of stuff. And they were talking about doing all this work to bring people to the Morongo Basin, to bring people to Joshua Tree National Park. And another reporter was there, and the reporter raised her hand and said, you know, you're talking about bringing people here, but when they get here, there's no place to put them. There's no place for them to eat. So I think we need to put the infrastructure before we say, come here. And I think that's kind of the mistake that was made. But infrastructure is usually driven by profit.
Right.
I mean, you get a lot of busy area. Someone's going to build a hotel. There's going to be a restaurant. And that didn't happen here. But we got the visitors.
Right. And some of the issue there is that Joshua Tree National Park, the people that run Joshua Tree National Park don't necessarily have a say in that that outreach. You know, they're directed to do one thing or another by the National Park Service, which is directed to do one thing or another by the Department of Interior, and a lot of these.
Well, it should be the visitor centers, the city, the town, those people who are impacted, not in the park, who are looking for, are doing the planning, the infrastructure planning. Again, yeah. People come to Joshua Tree. What is it? What do they have to do there?
Yeah.
And the guy, the Joshua Tree Rock Shop, actually built a fun little event. He's got a little sluice board, and the kids can pay a few bucks, and they walk off with some cool colored rocks and stuff. It's great, and they need more of that kind of thing rather than just a shop.
Yep. Well, and even just places to stay is such an important issue, and it's more than just capacity. You know, because you can have a bunch of vacancies in the $500 a night and up sector of the Airbnb market, and it's still an immense problem for most people. I got into this in part because my parents loaded us up into the Malibu station wagon in 1966 and took us cross-country, and we camped and saw all these national parks. Joshua Tree National Monument was not included in that trip, sadly, though we were close by. But we spent a lot of time pulling up to places, paying whatever the 1966 equivalent of $20 was, and sleeping on the ground and going to do stuff. And there are so many families in Southern California that I think that would be how they could afford to come visit. And we don't have an organized way in which they can do that.
A few years ago, we had David Smith on the show. I said, David, what can the locals do to support this? He said, open a campground.
Mm-hmm.
Open. I know the Torrent Palms Band of Mission Indians is planning on doing an RV park up on their property, which is appropriate and good for them. I'm glad they're doing it. They're actually opening a trailhead mm-hmm. at that casino so people could enter the park from the Indian property there. So they're doing some infrastructures, but it's just coming so slowly. My producer's telling me I got a phone call on, so let's go to it. Jody, you're on the radio. Good morning.
Pardon me?
You're on the radio. Good morning.
Oh, hey, good morning, Gary.
And your comment today.
I just wanted to pose this question. Remember when, as you were talking a little while ago about the line of cars all the way up Park Boulevard, all the way up into the park, right?
Yep.
And, okay, so what's going to happen inside the park once they get the multiple entrance shacks open? You know what I mean? They're going to build them up to more ranger shacks to get people in faster?
Well, I don't know about getting in faster. I think it's to manage the flow is more important with the improvements to the entry stations. Not to get more people in, it's to manage that flow better. Chris, you think that's about right?
Yeah, essentially the kiosk is going to get moved into the park a little ways, and the thinking behind that is that it won't help for Meteor Garden. You know, if you have a line out to Interstate 10, that's not going to help. But if most days, that's going to reduce or eliminate the inconvenience to people that live right outside the park who can't get an ambulance or a plumber or, you know, themselves between home and work because people are blocking
the
driveways.
I totally understand that. But like I said, once you increase those guard shacks or ranger shacks and you get, you're going to get people in faster because, you know, there's more shacks. So I'm just saying, what's the damage going to do on the inside of the park once that takes place?
Okay.
I'm just curious.
That is a really important question, and I don't have a good answer for it. I think the park, one of the people that I'm hoping to get in this forum, and she is willing to do so if the scheduling works, is Superintendent Jane Rogers. And she can provide what the park has been thinking about overall visitation management.
And by the way, congratulations, Jane Rogers. You won national recognition yesterday from the National Park Service. So congratulations.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Yeah. All right, I'll go ahead and let you guys go.
All right, thanks, Jody.
Jody, thank you for calling.
All right. And there's another subject for you to put on the list for the forum. So we are gradually building, you know, what's on people's mind? What do they care about? What are their priorities? We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with Chris Clark, the California Associate Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. I know that's not the exact correct title.
Close enough.
It's close enough. We'll be right back. And we are back with the Z1077 Up Close Show. I'm Gary Dagneau. Our producer is Michelle Alley. Our guest is Chris Clark. And our phone number is 760-366-8471. Chris, while I've got you here, there's been some stuff going on environmentally, locally, and I'd like to get a little update. What's the latest on the proposal by Cadiz to pump all that water out and send it off to Orange County?
Well, they have not given up. We have them blocked on a couple of different fronts. They pretty much have to go through environmental assessment on the state and federal level if they're going to build a new pipeline. Right now, what they're trying to do is take over a retired oil and gas pipeline that goes roughly along Route 66, and that would connect them up to the Central Valley and three or four potential aqueducts that they could hook into, you know, the Owens Valley LADWP aqueduct, the California Water Project, California Aqueduct, I'm sorry, the Mojave Water Agency's pipeline. So what they are lately trying to do is just bide their time until they get a friendlier administration in either the White House or Sacramento. And in the meantime, they are trying to do some sort of extreme PR repair, because they have been essentially a third rail for a lot of environmental leaning elected officials.
Yeah, I see a lot of reference to them trying to pump water out of the desert for the urban area.
Yeah, I think, for instance, Kevin DeLeon probably lost his Senate seat in large part because of his position on Cadiz, and you know, he was a viable candidate, and his support of Cadiz helped sink him. But what they're doing as part of that PR effort is to find ways to frame themselves as an environmental justice organization, saying we just want to bring a reliable, safe, and affordable source of water to California's frontline communities. And you know, never mind that they will be neither reliable nor safe nor affordable. It's going to be some of the most expensive water that is available in Southern California. It's got chromium-6 and arsenic in it, among other things. And, you know, if they start affecting the springs as they pump, they're going to get shut down eventually, so that's not reliable. You know, communities that are built with the assumption that Cadiz water is going to be part of what supports them will be out of luck. But they'd rather we not look at any of that, and they're pushing themselves as the savior of local communities of color that need reliable access to water. And we have we've built a pretty good coalition, and is continuing to grow, and there are a lot of environmental justice groups in California that are not buying it, and they're seeing as essentially as Cadiz trying to hoodwink them into supporting it.
It's like a dog with a bone. Cadiz just won't let go.
Well, they have hedge fund backing. And the thing about hedge funds, especially if they are not local and don't see what's going on with local politics, is that they are willing to lose lots of money. You know, hedge fund backed projects, if they lose money on 9 of them but make money on the 10th, they're happy. So they're willing to keep Cadiz afloat for quite a long time, and that's, I think, what we're basically up against.
So the bottom line is Cadiz is waiting for a friendly administration, but still keeping their feelers out on these pipelines.
Essentially, yeah. And in the meantime, the science is piling up. We have 2 peer-reviewed studies that were out in 2018, which is, you know, a while ago, but they're still pretty current. That show that the aquifer that Cadiz would tap is connected to springs, especially Bonanza Spring, which I'm pretty sure we've talked about, but also a number of other springs that are really critical to wildlife, especially considering that the desert, although it's a little funny to say this week, but the desert is going to be drying out as a result of climate change.
I was going to talk to you about that, so that's a good little segue. What is the status right now of the Western Joshua Tree? What?
I am still coming up to speed on precisely what the new law means.
What does it mean? Yeah.
Basically, it's roughly equivalent to it being listed as a threatened species. There are some differences in the details, and I'm actually going to be, I think, at least in theory, getting together with the one of the authors of that legislation, Brendan Cummings from Center for Biological Diversity, this weekend. So he can tell me if I make any mistakes here. But essentially, it prohibits most people from damaging Joshua trees. There are some exemptions. One exemption that's fairly controversial includes large solar developers who can pay a fee per tree and continue as they were. They don't mind that, apparently, because it's some certainty. The other exemption is for homeowners who have a problem Joshua tree is going to fall on their house, that kind of thing. They still need to get a permit, but the fees are waived.
I know personally people in Joshua in Yucca Valley who had to move out of their house because their families were growing and they couldn't put a bedroom on or anything because there's a Joshua tree. So the prohibition of Joshua tree is affecting people's lives, on the ground. Does this new legislation allow the local jurisdiction, in this case the town of Yucca Valley, to do the licensing, or does it still have to go through the state of California?
I'm going to defer answering on that one because I'm not certain, but my understanding, as vague as it is that Yucca Valley will still be a permitting authority.
Putting Chris on the spot a little bit because they're still working out these details. So yep. some of these questions there are no answer to. So that's why. But they need to come up with answers to that.
Yeah, and they, I'm confident that they will. Some of the fees for disturbing Joshua trees are going to be reevaluated in a couple of years, just so that they can make sure that they are actually working and that they are providing a disincentive toward needless destruction of Joshua trees and providing some money to preserve habitat, but at the same time not unduly affecting the homeowner who's got a Joshua tree that just fell across the driveway.
So hang on, Yucca Valley, they're still figuring it out.
Yep.
Yeah, but I'm sure we'll get that information out. I see that the Mojave Desert Land Trust has got an event coming up to talk about the western Joshua trees. I think it's coming up this weekend. Yeah.
Well, there's your source for actually more reliable information than me doing my arm waving here. But essentially, this was not uniformly popular law among the environmental side, but I think it's a lot better than the initial version of the bill, which would have...
Well, the initial version was draconian, and I think a little overreach.
And it also undermined the California Endangered Species Act a little bit by providing an alternative. But I think now it's a promising work in progress, and I am... a little bit embarrassed that I don't know the precise details about the...
But no one knows the precise details yet. No. So I'm gonna defend you on that one. So they're still figuring it out.
This is the opposite of gotcha journalism, right?
Yeah, it's the opposite of gotcha journalism. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of the Z1077 Up Close Show. Our guest in studio, Chris Clark from the California, from the National Park Conservation Association. And Chris is planning an event, a forum for later on next month, and which they'll be discussing sustainable tourism, the effects of visitation to the park. And we're asking you to call us and tell us what subjects you'd like to have brought up. So far we had a few people call in with very good subjects. If you've got more, let us know. Our lines are open. Our producer's Michelle Alley. The number is 760-366-8471. We're going to take one final break and be back with more of the Z1077 Up Close Show.
Interest rates on hardware don't fluctuate with the Federal Reserve. This is Patty Brown, a.k.a. the Loan Lady or the Queen of Green. Do you need cash for home improvements? Trying to fix up your home to put on the market? We offer great alternatives and flexible lending for home improvement loans and mortgages. Our money to loan comes from local investors looking to invest in people, not credit scores. We've got money for your next project available and fast closing, too. Call me today at 365-7003. The Loan Lady. We want to be your real estate lender.
At Morongo Basin Community Health Center, your health is our priority. That's why we have medical specialists, including chiropractic, behavioral health, and now dermatology, available right here in our convenient Yucca Valley and 29 Palms clinics. Make an appointment today. Call 760-365-9305 or log on to our new website, morongobasinhealth.org. Morongo Basin Community Health Center, a program of Morongo Basin Healthcare District.
And we are back with the Z1077 Up Close Show. Our guest from the National Park Conservation Association, Chris Clark. So, Chris, I was doing a little homework earlier, and I was looking up National Park Conservation Association, some of the things they do. And one of the things they're talking about now is the underfunding of the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
And I read somewhere, and you may have more accurate figures, that even though Joshua Tree National Park is, I think, like the 10th or 11th most visited park, it's like the 60th or 70th in funding per capita.
Yeah.
Why is Joshua Tree getting the short end of that stick? What's going on?
Well, there are a lot of ins and outs of the politics there, but essentially it's because Joshua Tree's visitation spike has only occurred in the last 15 years. I mean, it's been increasing since the 1930s, but the spike really happened basically since I've been living here.
The Instagram generation. Yeah.
And federal funding for parks doesn't get tacked to visitation rates. It's a lot harder to pass a funding increase for the National Park Service than it was in, say, the 60s or 70s. It's a lot harder to pass anything right now. But one impression that kept coming up during Meteorgeddon and the social media discussion of that was that suddenly the park is going to have all of this cash from all of the entry fees for these people that are stacked up in line to go look at meteors, you know, underneath the glare of 100,000 headlights. And that there's some truth to that, but that that funding that comes in from your money at the gate doesn't all stay with Joshua Tree National Park. Some of it, a significant percentage of it, is put into a pool that is split up between the parks that don't have entry fees. And even the money that Joshua Tree keeps can only be used on certain things, infrastructural things that directly affect visitor experience. So fixing the bathroom at the Oasis Visitor Center, that kind of thing, that can be done with those funds. But starting a new visitor management plan or anything like that, they're restricted from spending that money on things that would make sense for visitors in the long run but aren't directly impacting the visitor experience.
So one would think if the park was very, very busy, they'd be generating more income, but it doesn't really work that way.
Yeah, they are generating more income, but they can't use it for everything they want to. And sometimes the things that they can use it for are things they've already accomplished. And so it's a little tricky for park managers to count on that.
One of the things the National Park Conservation Association is dedicated to is working with the communities to protect National Park. What can our communities around our beloved Joshua Tree National Park, what can the communities do to help protect that asset?
I think, well, first off, coming to the forum, it would be a really good place to just make sure we're all on the same page. And it strikes me, I should say, one other way of finding out the details when they are set is to listen to the next episode of our podcast, 90 Miles from Needles, because we're co-sponsoring it. We'll probably be recording the forum for use as a podcast episode. We are the second most popular desert podcast after Ken Lane's fine Desert Oracle.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just looking forward to being part of that conversation as well. But I think being your best self, you know, we all get annoyed at people that are clueless. Everybody starts out clueless. And so
a little patience.
Yeah, trying to be patient, trying our best to educate people, saying, hey, you know, we don't really honk at people in traffic here.
Yeah.
You know, please do not assume that somebody's going to pick up after your dog in the park. You know, just stuff like that. Just education on a one-by-one level. And it's daunting, and it's tiring, and it's exhausting, but it needs to happen. Every single person that's here is a new person. So if we're upset because for the last 2 weeks we've run into 17 really thoughtless people that are visiting, that 18th person isn't to blame for those until they start acting up. So,
and one of the things the park is doing is they've got a volunteer corps now of people from the communities who actually meet the visitors as they're at the trailheads and as they get out of their car and just tell them, I know you can't have your dog here. Maybe you should take the flip-flops and make sure you've got some water. It's preventative search and rescue.
Yep.
Which I think is a great concept.
And I know that JOSAR, Joshua Tree Search and Rescue, has been involved in developing that. One of my neighbors in my old neighborhood was very active in JOSAR, so we'd get all the details of the politics involved, and as well as some of the efforts to find people and rescue them. And it's a tricky park because it is dangerous. You know, all national parks are dangerous if you try hard enough, but Joshua Tree is dangerous even if you don't try to put yourself in danger.
And there's kind of the mindset, like it's some sort of like amusement park. And I don't know if you've ever seen the posters they made up out of people's complaints on Yelp.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing to do here but walk around and look at trees.
You know, a little secret, that particular poster was based on a satirical Yelp review that I put.
Oh, was it?
So I should be getting royalties on those posters.
You should, because those posters are all over the place. But,
yep.
Yeah. But I don't think a lot of us here who are experienced, who are here, who know our park, think about the people who are showing here, know nothing. They're absolutely clueless. So we need to help give them that clue. Yep. Chris Clark, thanks for coming in. That phone number again is 760-392-1996 to participate in the 90 Miles from Needles podcast and the forum that will be coming up. We'll be announcing the date and time of that forum as soon as Chris puts all those pieces together.
Yep.
Thanks for coming in. Thank you for protecting our desert.
Thank you for being one of the voices in favor of desert protection and for having me on the show. It's always good to see you.
That's going
to
do it for the Up Close Show. Sure, join me next week for more. Until then, thanks for listening. Drive carefully and God bless. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Up Close, a weekly talk and interview program presented in the public interest by Z1077 News. Join Gary Denyeau again next Friday at 10 for more Up Close.